I think you can argue very easily that they probably have, I think, the most valuable content library in the world. Look, they were getting 300 million plus from Netflix a year for the 10 or so movies that Netflix was allowed to stream. So I think that gives you an idea just how valuable it is.
Author Lou Mongello on Disney's decision to go it alone in the next phase of the streaming wars. We'll find out why this might be a case of Hollywood's history on repeat today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
It was hot just to touch the suit, and that was before he got into it and before it was under the lights. And he said, I love this phrase. He says, I was sweating all over my face, but I did the best I could.
We'll farewell the not-so-scary man behind one of the cinema's scariest giant beasts, Godzilla. And
I don't think that many people know about his personal history. I don't think that many people know about his growth as a human being. And I think that is very interesting if you look at the art that Tom of Finland has made. What kind of person is behind those drawings?
As the new film Tom of Finland hits cinemas, we'll catch up with the director in Helsinki. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. In the future, we won't need to hail a cab or even order an Uber. We'll have teleporters. And even if you do prefer the scenic route, well, we'll have flying cars for that. Pizzas will come in bite-size form, ready for enlarging at home. Yes, remember that scene in Back to the Future Part 2? And home maintenance will be a dream of automation. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. The future, as envisioned by generations of movie makers, is in many ways already here. But with subscription plans competing with one-off rental or buying fees, and no cohesive platform for bringing together all the options, the streaming marketplace is quickly becoming one big mess. But while the internet might be young, the history of how we watch movies has plenty to teach us. Just as Marty McFly called up various channels on his giant television, scrolling through Netflix or searching for your favourite film on Amazon or Google Play probably couldn't be any easier. But what about venturing out to an actual cinema?
MoviePass was kind of an ally with the theatre chain AMC, which was looking at ways of increasing customer loyalty. Cinema revenue has gone up in the States, but the number of people going to the cinema has been in steady decline.
That's the journalist and media commentator Stephen Armstrong. It might sound like a flight of fiction to think of the film industry as one in financial decline. After all, just about anything under the Marvel umbrella continues to storm the box office with a seemingly bulletproof Midas touch. But of course, while cinema ticket prices have been on a steady increase, the number of people buying them has slowly dipped. That's where MoviePass hopes to change the tide.
Mitch has arrived and he has decided that the pricing structures, all these ideas out the window, the best thing to do, a flat $10, well, in fact, $9.95 fee and unlimited access. It works. You sign up, they send you a debit card. And when you choose on your smartphone which film you want to go and see, the smart card, the debit card, is charged with the price of that admission for you. So you use the MoviePass debit card to buy your tickets when you go to the cinema.
The Mitch Stephen is referring to is Mitch Lowe, once an executive at Netflix and now in charge of a company that's offering unlimited access to new release films in more than 4,000 cinemas across the United States.
Mitch Lowe really has come on board to a small, little regarded movie add-on company and switched it around by pulling in new investment and changing its approach. Already, we've seen since Mitch Lowe's arrived, the cinema chain AMC start to pull back from MoviePass and start to go to war with it in a classic Hollywood versus newcomer kind of way.
AMC's uncertainty over the new kid on the block is in some ways reminiscent of the All Movie Channels battle when it decided to remake itself as an acronym, home to original series like Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead. But the thing about taking on a classic big name and trying to beat them at their own game is that they can often end up changing you more than you can change them.
But it found that when you take on Hollywood head to head, in the end, particularly Hollywood, more even than the music industry, definitely more than the newspaper industry, you need to be prepared for a fight back. And in the end, what Netflix had to do, Netflix is effectively a movie studio these days. It's making more of its own content than it is buying in.
In its quest for global domination, Netflix has accumulated more than $20 billion of debt with no plans of slowing down. So what do you call an entertainment company that makes its own product and distributes it on its own exclusive channel? A movie studio, of course. The kind that was declared illegal in 1948. Let's put this into some context. Back in the 1940s, a long, long-running court case was nearing its final conclusion in the United States Supreme Court. It had actually been doing the rounds since the era of silent films, soon after the film industry in Hollywood had graduated from a few dusty warehouses ruled by gangsters and cowboys into one of the most lucrative sectors in the world. The government, perhaps unsurprisingly, began treating studios like actual companies with legal obligations. What began as an investigation by the Federal Trade Commission eventually led to all the major studios being sued by the Department of Justice in 1938. Back then, Hollywood was at the peak of its powers. Gone with the Wind was about to hit theaters. MGM was the envy of film companies and budding young stars everywhere. But many of those who weren't envious saw only a hungry beast that needed to be tamed. The Big Five, as they were known, enjoyed immense control over the way people saw their movies. Some might call it total control. Movies were produced in-house by staff or contractors. Actors and directors were signed to a studio for years at a time, with the studio ultimately in control of who got to star or direct in what and when. The studios also controlled their own publicity. Even the backstory for stars like Marilyn Monroe was completely made up by Fox's publicity department. And by owning chains of theaters, they even controlled how people watched their movies. With television still in its infancy and the internet barely a fantasy, the Big Five movie studios quite literally owned entertainment. Then it all came crashing down. After 10 years of legal wrangling, the court finally ordered the studios to divest themselves of the theaters that they owned, effectively outlawing their business model.
I think you can argue very easily that they probably have, I think, the most valuable content library in the world. Look, they were getting $300 million plus from Netflix a year for the 10 or so movies that Netflix was allowed to stream. So I think that gives you an idea just how valuable it is.
That's the author and radio presenter Lou Mongello. The decision by Disney to remove its library from Netflix and go it alone via its own exclusive streaming platform caught many people by surprise.
But I don't think this is very much of a shock. I think that when they created this agreement back in 2012, they knew it was going to be a limited time deal. They wanted to test the market. They wanted to learn from it and eventually launch their own, because it is a better way to not only share the content from the movies, original content and TV, but really help to connect directly with their consumers.
Sound familiar? Well, Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu are already producing their own content, which is available exclusively via their own streaming platforms. Disney may be the first big studio to gather its product into one exclusive online channel, but it absolutely won't be the last. Old Hollywood may be a distant memory, but its business model seems to be making quite the comeback, albeit with a few key differences.
They want to build up their own proprietary version of this. It's the data. It's what we go and see, when we go and see it, who we are, and why we might see it. So they can start mapping our behavior, start predicting, start selling to us, all sorts of things. They don't really want to have all of their audience's purchasing habits in the hands of a third party.
Technology giant Apple will invest $1 billion into developing its own original programming over the next 12 months, a figure that, for now, puts it below Amazon and Netflix. But if history is anything to go by here, it's less about what we're watching, and more about how we're watching it. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. The world of cinema recently lost one of its most ferocious leading actors, a man who's perhaps provoked more screams in the world's darkened theatres than any other. Godzilla is, of course, the screen's quintessential giant monster, and one of the most recognisable symbols of Japanese popular culture. The King of Monsters came into being in 1954, with his atomic breath meant as a metaphor for nuclear weapons. The man who wore the costume for the first 12 films, Haruo Nakajima, passed away last week. Here's the film critic, Karen Krasanovich, speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin.
Well, Godzilla is actually, there's a word for a bomb-affected person, and it's called hibakusha. Now, I can't speak Japanese. I've tried. That's basically what Godzilla is, or Gojira is his Japanese name. He's a creature that's affected by this horrible atomic blast. Now, remember that the original film came out 9 years after the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb. This is Japan trying to come to terms with its relationship with nature, but also how it affected generations afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, recently it's been played by actors in latex suits or created in CGI, but the original Godzilla costume was incredibly heavy.
It was post-World War II, and the rubber was very difficult to come by, so they actually used concrete to make the suit. I'm trying to figure out how they did concrete to make the suit, but it's wonderful because Nakajima says it was hot just to touch the suit, and that was before he got into it and before it was under the lights. And he said, I love this phrase. He says, I was sweating all over my face, but I did the best I could.
Oh, and one wonders how he took breaks, comfort breaks.
Actually, my screensaver for a long time was him taking, with a big smile on his face, taking a sip of tea with the Godzilla head peeled off of him. So they took breaks every few minutes because it was so swelteringly hot inside.
It must have been appalling. You were talking about sort of Japanese words put together, and I understand that the name itself is a bit of a portmanteau, and I think it's made up from gorilla and whale.
And whale.
And so it was actually real life animals that gave him his inspiration of how to move, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, oh, absolutely. Nakajima, because he has about 19 stunt credits and 57 film credits to his name. Now, he was seen by Godzilla director Ishiro Honda leaping out of a plane on fire for a World War II film. And he said, I'm sure that he saw that I had guts and energy. I love that, guts and energy. So he dedicated himself as one of the best suit actors in the business. Now, this was a type of filmmaking called tokusatsu, which is not the pork cutlet, which is tonkatsu. I get it confused. He was one of the best. And one of the reasons he was the best, he went to the zoo and he watched bears and also elephants move because he wanted the creature to be believable.
Now, Godzilla has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Yes.
The new film has come out, so obviously Nakajima's legacy lives on. Why does Godzilla still matter?
I think there's an environmental message there. I also think it's a really, because I just saw the new film yesterday. It's just a really cool looking, it's basically a warped dinosaur with rage and it has an amazing sound. And I think it's not only visually amazing, immediately recognizable, and they guard that copyright, you know, very, very fiercely. But I think there is an environmental message there. And he's the monster that really is the god of monsters. That's why he's got that name. They were calling him Godzilla. There's a reason.
Tell us about the new film.
The new film is really interesting. I don't want to give too much away. When I was watching it the first half an hour in, there's a lot of detail. It really is a commentary on how Japan handled the nuclear crisis after the tsunami, where a lot of the older people were not making the right decisions. The young people wanted to make decisions. There's a lot of people named, a lot of captions, but the monster is amazing. I was surprised. The less you know about this, the better. Visually, it's astonishing. Go and see it. I really enjoyed it.
And presumably this is a CGI monster?
I think it is. I haven't really looked into the if there was a practical effects there or not. But one thing that did disturb me, he doesn't have eyelids in this movie. So that was like, he used to blink. What happened? But maybe he didn't. I don't know. I was remembering him blinking. But it is an astonishing film, and the creativity put into the design of Godzilla will blow your mind.
Karen Krasanovich speaking to Georgina Godwin. Still to come, we'll speak to the director of Tom of Finland as the film arrives in UK cinemas. This is The Cinema Show. If you like good films, well, our friends over at Mubi have got an extra special treat for you. Mubi is the home of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. And among the films you will find playing right now is In a World, the debut film from Lake Bell, set in the rather unexpected world of people providing voiceovers for movie trailers. There's also the excellent 2009 science fiction film District 9, which puts a very clever alien spin on the concept of immigration. And a personal favourite of mine, the 1959 adaptation of the classic Tennessee Williams play Suddenly Last Summer, starring Katharine Hepburn, Elizabeth Taylor, and Montgomery Clift. The wise people of Mubi carefully curate a rotating list of 30 films, all of them excellent cinema. You'll never be caught in that infamous, endless scrolling vortex ever again. Sample a whole month of Mubi right now for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. When a young Tuukka Laaksonen returned home from serving in the Second World War, he was met with a painful reminder that, despite his sacrifice, he was still considered an enemy by his country. It was partly that experience that drove him into a career as an artist, and, better known as Tom of Finland, his work became legendary, instantly recognisable to generations of gay men. A new film recalls the real-life story of Tom of Finland. Petri Bertsov met its director in Helsinki.
Tom of Finland was a gay icon. His drawings of bulky, strong men clad in leather uniforms helped consolidate a new masculinized image of a homosexual man from the 1960s onwards. The cultural historian Joseph W. Slate called Tom of Finland the world's most influential creator of gay pornographic images. Tom of Finland was an artistic pseudonym of Touko Laaksonen, a man from a small Finnish town of Kaarina who hid both his artistry and his homosexuality for most of his lifetime. Laaksonen died in 1991 having lived a life of contradictions. Through his homoerotic art, he was and remains one of the most internationally renowned Finnish artists, but throughout most of his lifetime, homosexuality was considered both a crime and a mental illness in his native country. These contradictions are at the heart of the Finnish director Dome Karukoski's new biopic Tom of Finland that charts the artist's journey through the decades, starting from the Second World War until his breakthrough and mainstream success in America.
You know, we used to put scum like you into concentration camps and gas them to death.
Saksalaisten silmissä te olette joko vakoja tai ainakin rikollinen. Mutta kyllä minä tiedän, mitä te olette.
It was very much a character film about the personal history of Tom of Finland, a.k.a. Touko Laaksonen. And what was interesting, if you Google Tom of Finland, you get millions and millions of hits. But if you Google Touko Laaksonen, you only get a few. So I don't think that many people know about his personal history. I don't think that many people know about his growth as a human being. And I think that is very interesting if you look at the art, what Tom of Finland has made, what kind of person is behind those drawings. Touko Laaksonen was a very shameless man. He didn't have an inner conflict about his sexuality. He was very sure about his sexuality. I think in many ways he was very courageous, but also, as most importantly, shameless. And I think I relate to that, and I think it was very interesting following a person. He had a kind of a strength in him, an inner strength, and I think that was interesting for me to learn, and how he conveyed that inner strength into this art, I think built something, kind of a relationship towards the character with me as a personality, not just as a person, not just as a director. And I think that was something that he or this story kind of educated me about. And I'm trying always to cross shame's boundaries. So if there's something that I'm ashamed of, I try to cross that boundary. You know, if there's something, you know, you're not allowed to touch, or you feel that I shouldn't probably do this or say this, then go for it. You know, if you have an urge, you want to, but, you know, there's something stopping you, some kind of a shame boundary that has been taught to us. And I think crossing those boundaries has made me a more self-secure person.
Dome Karukoski is known in Finland as a director whose films touch on difficult and controversial topics. Finland is still very polarized when it comes to attitudes towards homosexuality. While Tom of Finland's art is celebrated officially, so much so that Karukoski's film is part of Finland's centenary as an independent state, in smaller towns and in the countryside, homosexuality can still be a taboo. Karukoski says, however, that his motivation for directing Tom of Finland were not political.
You shouldn't make an agenda film. I think as a film as an agenda is usually fails on the second act. You know, you're looking at a character that is doing something legal and the dramatics comes out of that, and then that illegal turns out to be a revolution. And I think that's a great cinematic story. But then secondly, of course, there's always the motivation as an artist. I've made a film about the neo-Nazi change. I made a film about a religious sect. I made a film about outcasts of society. I've always had that want and need to affect. And I think that how to affect or have a say in the film, that what the film tries to say, it has to come through the story. And I know it's a cliche, but I basically, there's a nice saying in Finnish, which is, we went out to do some entertainment, and then if it slipped into art, that's okay.
This could be cover material. We need something more. For a cover artist, we need something more. Tom.
The movie emphasizes the fact that, first and foremost, Tom of Finland, or Touko Laaksonen, was an artist at heart. There's a line in the movie in which he says, I'm not a freedom fighter, I just draw, or something like that. But then, after the anti-gay demonstrations in the US, he kind of realizes the political agency, the political power of his work, and starts to embrace it. Do you think the fact that his art needed to be underground had an effect on his work? If Touko Laaksonen and Tom of Finland was born in today's more tolerant society, do you think his art would have taken a different path?
Possibly, and most likely. Pekka Strong, the actor playing Tom of Finland, he said it very well, that freedom is like water. If you put a stone in front of water, it finds a way. But the stone, of course, makes it interesting. And also, if you look at making a film, it's a more interesting story, his story, if, you know, he has actually had obstacles, if there is some kind of a conflict. And I think, of course, that conflict and his drawings being forbidden and illegal, that, of course, has, I think, even arose his passion. He had passion towards drawing, towards being an artist. But I think when society is trying to block you and force you into something, I think that actually engages more passion. And we've seen it before. It's that's where revolution rises. You know, when you try to confine people or you try to like jail thoughts and minds, you know, then the minds want to break free. And I think that happened also with Tom of Finland.
Tom of Finland premiered in Finland and Sweden this spring and will hit the cinema screens elsewhere in the world later this year. It will have its American premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival, where it has been chosen to compete in the main category. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Dome Karukoski's new film, Tom of Finland, is out in cinemas now. If you missed my interview with David Lowry, writer and director of the extraordinary new film, A Ghost Story, be sure to have a listen. It really is one of the best films you'll see this year. And for more tips on what to watch over the weekend, well, be sure to pick up a copy of Monocle's new newspaper, The Summer Weekly. It's out on newsstands this Thursday. Today's show was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolin Goffan. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.
Too much. All the awful dreams felt real enough. Did you love her then? She waking up? Did she?